she likes to wake me up with a bucket of ice-cold water. But in this case, I didn't mind. The water disrupted the smoke, allowing me to roll away and gasp for air. Nearby, our two gaseous enemies reformed as dripping wet corpses, their yellow eyes glowing with annoyance. Meg yelled again. This time, I understood her words.
Get down!
I found this inconsiderate, since I'd only just gotten up. All around the orchard, the frozen, blackened remnants of the harvest were beginning to levitate. Believe me, in 4,000 years, I have seen some strange things. I have seen the dreaming face of Uranos etched in stars across the heavens, and the full fury of Typhon as he raged across the earth. I've seen men turn into snakes, ants turn into men, and otherwise rational people dance the Macarena. But never before had I seen an uprising of frozen fruit. Percy and I hit the ground as peaches shot around the orchard, ricocheting off trees like eight balls, ripping through the Nosoi's cadaverous bodies. If I had been standing up, I would have been killed. But Meg simply stood there, unfazed and unhurt, as frozen dead fruit zinged around her. All three Nosoi collapsed, riddled with holes. Every piece of fruit dropped to the ground. Percy looked up, his eyes red and puffy.
What just happened?
He sounded congested, which meant he hadn't completely escaped the effects of the plague cloud, but at least he wasn't dead. That was generally a good sign.
I don't know, I admitted.
Meg? Is it safe? She was staring in amazement at the carnage of fruit, mangled corpses, and broken tree limbs.
I'm not sure.
How'd you do that?
Percy snuffled. Meg looked horrified.
I didn't. I just knew it would happen.
One of the cadavers began to stir. It got up, wobbling on its heavily perforated legs.
But you did do it, the spirit growled. You are strong, child.
The other two corpses rose.
Not strong enough, said the second Nosos. We will finish you now.
The third spirit bared his rotten teeth.
Your guardian would be so disappointed.
Guardian? Perhaps the spirit meant me. When in doubt, I usually assumed the conversation was about me. Meg looked as if she'd been punched in the gut. Her face paled. Her arms trembled. She stamped her foot and yelled,
No!
More peaches swirled into the air. This time, the fruit blurred together in a fructose dust devil, until standing in front of Meg was a creature like a pudgy human toddler wearing only a linen diaper. Protruding from his back were wings made of leafy branches. His babyish face might have been cute, except for the glowing green eyes and pointy fangs. The creature snarled and snapped at the air.
Oh, no. Percy shook his head. I hate these things.
The three Nosoi also did not look pleased. They edged away from the snarling baby.
What is it?
Meg asked. I stared at her in disbelief. She had to be the cause of this fruit-based strangeness, but she looked as shocked as we were. Unfortunately, if Meg didn't know how she had summoned this creature, she would not know how to make it go away. And like Percy Jackson, I was no fan of Carpoy. It's a grain spirit, I said, trying to keep the panic out of my voice. I've never seen a peach carpost before, but if it's as vicious as other types... I was about to say we're doomed, but that seemed both obvious and depressing. The peach baby turned toward the Nosoi. For a moment, I feared he would make some hellish alliance, an axis of evil between illnesses and fruits. The middle corpse, the one with the peach in his forehead, inched backward.
Do not interfere,
he warned the Karpos.
We will not allow.
The peach baby launched himself at the Knossos and bit his head off. That is not a figure of speech. The Karpos's fanged mouth unhinged, expanding to an unbelievable circumference, then closed around the cadaver's head and chomped it off in one bite. Oh dear, I hope you weren't eating dinner as you read that. In a matter of seconds, the Knossos had been torn to shreds and devoured. Understandably, the other two Knossoi retreated. But the Karpos crouched and sprang. He landed on the second corpse and proceeded to rip it into plague-flavored cream of wheat. The last spirit dissolved into glittering smoke and tried to fly away, but the peach baby spread his leafy wings and launched himself in pursuit. He opened his mouth and inhaled the sickness, snapping and swallowing until every wisp of smoke was gone. He landed in front of Meg and belched. His green eyes gleamed. He did not appear even slightly sick, which I suppose wasn't surprising since human diseases don't infect fruit trees. Instead, even after eating three whole Knossoi, the little fellow looked hungry. He howled and beat his small chest.
Peaches!
Slowly, Percy raised his sword. His nose was still red and runny, and his face was puffy.
Meg, don't move, he snuffled. I'm gonna...
No, she said. Don't hurt him.
She put her hand tentatively on the creature's curly head.
You saved us, she told the Karpos. Thank you.
I started mentally preparing a list of herbal remedies for regenerating severed limbs, but to my surprise, the peach baby did not bite off Meg's hand. Instead, he hugged Meg's leg and glared at us as if daring us to approach.
Peaches!
He growled. He likes you, Percy noted.
Why?
I don't know, Meg said. Honestly, I didn't summon him.
I was certain Meg had summoned him, intentionally or unintentionally. I also had some ideas now about her godly parentage, and some questions about this guardian that the spirits had mentioned, but I decided it would be better to interrogate her when she did not have a snarling, carnivorous toddler wrapped around her leg. Well, whatever the case, I said, we owe the Karpos our lives. This brings to mind an expression I coined ages ago. A peach a day keeps the plague spirits away. Percy sneezed.
I thought it was apples and doctors.
The Karpos hissed.
Or peaches, Percy said.
Peaches work too.
Peaches,
agreed the Karpos. Percy wiped his nose.
Not criticizing, but why is he grooting?
Meg frowned.
Grooting?
Yeah, like the character of the movie? Only saying one thing over and over?
I'm afraid I haven't seen that movie, I said. But this Karpos does seem to have a very targeted vocabulary.
Maybe Peaches is his name.
Meg stroked the Karpos's curly brown hair, which elicited a demonic purring from the creature's throat.
That's what I'll call him.
Whoa, you are not adopting that.
Percy sneezed with such force, another irrigation pipe exploded behind him, sending up a row of tiny geysers.
Ugh, sick.
You're lucky, I said. Your trick with the water diluted the spirit's power. Instead of getting a deadly illness, you got a head cold.
I hate head colds.
His green irises looked like they were sinking in a sea of bloodshot.
Neither of you got sick?
Meg shook her head. I have an excellent constitution, I said. No doubt that's what saved me.
And the fact that I hosed the smoke off of you, Percy said.
Well, yes. Percy stared at me as if waiting for something. After an awkward moment, it occurred to me that if he was a god and I was a worshipper, he might expect gratitude.
Ah! Thank you, I said.
He nodded.
No problem.
I relaxed a little. If he had demanded a sacrifice, like a white bull or a fatted calf, I'm not sure what I would have done.
Can we go now?
Meg asked.
An excellent idea, I said. Though I'm afraid Percy is in no condition.
I could drive you the rest of the way, he said. If we can get my car out from between those trees.
He glanced in that direction, and his expression turned even more miserable.
Ah, Hades, no.
A police cruiser was pulling over on the side of the road. I imagined the officer's eyes tracing the tire ruts in the mud, which led to the plowed-down fence and continued to the blue Toyota Prius, wedged between two peach trees. The cruiser's roof lights flashed on.
Great, Percy muttered. If they tow the Prius, I'm dead. My mom and Paul need that car.
Go talk to the officers, I said. You won't be any use to us anyway in your current state.
Yeah, we'll be fine, Meg said. You said the camp is right over those hills?
Right, but...
Percy scowled, probably trying to think straight through the effects of his cold.
Most people enter camp from the east, where Half-Blood Hill is. The western border is wilder. Hills and woods, all heavily enchanted. If you're not careful, you could get lost.
He sneezed again.
I'm still not even sure Apollo could get in if he's fully mortal.
I'll get in.
I tried to exude confidence. I had no alternative. If I was unable to enter Camp Half-Blood...
No.
I'd already been attacked twice on my first day as a mortal. There was no plan B that would keep me alive. The police car's doors opened.
Go, I urged Percy.
We'll find our way through the woods. You explain to the police that you're sick and you lost control of the car. They'll go easy on you.
Percy laughed.
Yeah, cops love me almost as much as teachers do.
He glanced at Meg.
You sure you're okay with the baby fruit demon?
Peaches growled.
All good, Meg promised. Go home. Rest. Get lots of fluids.
Percy's mouth twitched.
You're telling a son of Poseidon to get lots of fluids.
Okay, just try to survive until the weekend, will you? I'll come to camp and check on you guys if I can. Be careful and...
Tchoo!
Muttering unhappily, he touched the cap of his pen to his sword, turning it back into a simple ballpoint. A wise precaution before approaching law enforcement. He trudged down the hill, sneezing and sniffling.
Officer! He called. Sorry, I'm up here. Can you tell me where Manhattan is?
Meg turned to me.
Ready?
I was soaking wet and shivering. I was having the worst day in the history of days. I was stuck with a scary girl and an even scarier peach baby. I was by no means ready for anything. But I also desperately wanted to reach camp. I might find some friendly faces there. Perhaps even jubilant worshippers who would bring me peeled grapes, Oreos, and other holy offerings.
Sure,
I said. Let's go. Peaches the Carpos grunted. He gestured for us to follow, then scampered toward the hills. Maybe he knew the way. Maybe he just wanted to lead us to a grisly death. Meg skipped after him, swinging from tree branches and cartwheeling through the mud as the mood took her. You might have thought we'd just finished a nice picnic rather than a battle with plague-ridden cadavers. I turned my face to the sky.
Are you sure, Zeus? It's not too late to tell me this was an elaborate prank and recall me to Olympus.
I've learned my lesson. I promise.
The gray winter clouds did not respond. With a sigh, I jogged after Meg and her homicidal new minion. Chapter 9. A walk through the woods. Voices driving me bonkers. I hate spaghetti. I sighed with relief. This should be easy. Granted, I'd said the same thing before I fought Poseidon in hand-to-hand combat. And that had not turned out to be easy. Nevertheless, our path into Camp Half-Blood looked straightforward enough. For starters, I was pleased I could see the camp, since it was normally shielded from mortal eyes. This boded well for me getting in. From where we stood at the top of a hill, the entire valley spread out below us. Roughly 3 square miles of woods, meadows, and strawberry fields, bordered by Long Island Sound to the north and rolling hills on the other 3 sides. Just below us, a dense forest of evergreens covered the western third of the vale. Beyond that, the buildings of Camp Half-Blood gleamed in the wintry light. The amphitheater, the sword-fighting stadium, the open-air dining pavilion with its white marble columns. A trireme floated in the canoe lake. 20 cabins lined the central green where the communal hearth fire glowed cheerfully. At the edge of the strawberry fields stood the big house, a 4-story Victorian painted sky blue with white trim. My friend Chiron would be inside, probably having tea by the fireplace. I would find sanctuary at last. My gaze rose to the far end of the valley. There, on the tallest hill, the Athena Parthenos shone in all its gold and alabaster glory. Once the massive statue had graced the Parthenon in Greece. Now it presided over Camp Half-Blood, protecting the valley from intruders. Even from here I could feel its power, like the subsonic thrum of a mighty engine. Old Grey Eyes was on the lookout for threats, being her usual vigilant, no-fun, all-business self. Personally, I would have installed a more interesting statue. Of myself, for instance. Still, the panorama of Camp Half-Blood was an impressive sight. My mood always improved when I saw the place. A small reminder of the good old days, when mortals knew how to build temples and do proper burnt sacrifices. Ah, everything was better in ancient Greece. Well, except for a few small improvements modern humans had made. The internet, chocolate croissants, life expectancy. Meg's mouth hung open. How come I've never heard about this place? Do you need tickets? I chuckled. I always enjoyed the chance to enlighten a clueless mortal. You see, Meg, magical borders camouflage the valley. From the outside, most humans would spy nothing here except boring farmland. If they approached, they would get turned around and find themselves wandering out again. Believe me, I tried to get a pizza delivered to camp once. It was quite annoying. You ordered a pizza? Never mind, I said. As for tickets, it's true the camp doesn't let in just anybody, but you're in luck. I know the management. Peaches growled. He sniffed the ground, then chomped a mouthful of dirt and spit it out. He doesn't like the taste of this place, Meg said. Yes, well, I frowned at the carpos. Perhaps we can find him some potting soil or fertilizer when we arrive. I'll convince the demigods to let him in, but it would be helpful if he doesn't bite their heads off. At least, not right away. Peaches muttered something about peaches. Something doesn't feel right. Meg bit her nails. Those woods. Percy said they were wild and enchanted and stuff. I too felt as if something was amiss, but I chalked this up to my general dislike of forests. For reasons I'd rather not go into, I find them uncomfortable places. Nevertheless, with our goal in sight, my usual optimism was returning. Don't worry, I assured Meg. You're traveling with a god.
Ex-god.
I wish you wouldn't keep harping on that. Anyway, the campers are very friendly. They'll welcome us with tears of joy. And wait until you see the orientation video.
The what?
I directed it myself. Now come along. The woods can't be that bad. The woods were that bad. As soon as we entered their shadows, the trees seemed to crowd us. Trunks closed ranks, blocking old paths and opening new ones. Roots writhed across the forest floor, making an obstacle course of bumps, knots, and loops. It was like trying to walk across a giant bowl of spaghetti. The thought of spaghetti made me hungry. It had only been a few hours since Sally Jackson's 7-layer dip and sandwiches, but my mortal stomach was already clenching and squelching for food. The sounds were quite annoying, especially while walking through dark, scary woods. Even the Carpos peaches was starting to smell good to me, giving me visions of cobbler and ice cream. As I said earlier, I was generally not a fan of the woods. I tried to convince myself that the trees were not watching me, scowling and whispering among themselves. They were just trees. Even if they had dryad spirits, those dryads couldn't possibly hold me responsible for what had happened thousands of years ago on a different continent. Why not? I asked myself. You still hold yourself responsible. I told myself to stuff a sock in it. We hiked for hours, much longer than it should have taken to reach the big house. Normally I could navigate by the sun, which shouldn't be a surprise, since I spent millennia driving it across the sky. But under the canopy of trees, the light was diffuse, the shadows confusing. After we passed the same boulder for the third time, I stopped and admitted the obvious. I have no idea where we are. Meg plopped herself down onto a fallen log. In the green light, she looked more like a dryad than ever. Though tree spirits do not often wear red sneakers and hand-me-down fleece jackets.
"Don't you have any wilderness skills?" she asked. "Reading moss on the sides of trees? Following tracks?"
"That's more my sister's thing," I said.
"Maybe peaches can help."
Meg turned to her Carpos.
"Hey, can you find us a way out of the woods?"
For the past few miles, the Carpos had been muttering nervously, cutting his eyes from side to side. Now he sniffed the air, his nostrils quivering. He tilted his head. His face flushed bright green. He emitted a distressed bark, then dissolved in a swirl of leaves. Meg shot to her feet.
"Where'd he go?"
I scanned the woods. I suspected Peaches had done the intelligent thing. He'd sensed danger approaching and abandoned us. I didn't want to suggest that to Meg, though. She'd already become quite fond of the Carpos. Ridiculous, getting attached to a small, dangerous creature. Then again, we gods got attached to humans, so I had no room to criticize. "Perhaps he went scouting," I suggested. "Perhaps we should..."
"Apollo!"
The voice reverberated in my head, as if someone had installed Bose speakers behind my eyes. It was not the voice of my conscience. My conscience was not female, and it was not that loud. Yet something about the woman's tone was eerily familiar.
"What's wrong?"
Meg asked. The air turned sickly sweet. The trees loomed over me like trigger hairs of a Venus flytrap. A bead of sweat trickled down the side of my face.
"We can't stay here," I said. "Attend me, mortal."
"Excuse me?"
Meg said.
Come on."
We ran, stumbling over tree roots, fleeing blindly through a maze of branches and boulders. We reached a clear stream over a bed of gravel. I barely slowed down. I waded in, sinking shin deep into the ice-cold water. The voice spoke again.
"Find me."
This time it was so loud it stabbed through my forehead like a railroad spike.
I stumbled, falling to my knees.
Hey! Meg gripped my arm. Get up!
You didn't hear that?
Hear what?
The fall of the sun, the voice boomed. The final verse!
I collapsed face first into the stream.
Apollo!
Meg rolled me over, her voice tight with alarm.
Come on, I can't carry you.
Yet she tried. She dragged me across the river, scolding me and cursing until, with her help, I managed to crawl to shore. I lay on my back, staring wildly at the forest canopy. My soaked clothes were so cold they burned. My body trembled like an open E-string on an electric bass. Meg tugged off my wet winter coat. Her own coat was much too small for me, but she draped the warm, dry fleece over my shoulders.
Keep yourself together, she ordered. Don't go crazy on me.
My own laughter sounded brittle.
But I heard. The fires will consume me. Make haste!
The voice splintered into a chorus of angry whispers. Shadows grew longer and darker. Steam rose from my clothes, smelling like the volcanic fumes of Delphi. Part of me wanted to curl into a ball and die. Part of me wanted to get up and run wildly after the voices, to find their source. But I suspected that if I tried, my sanity would be lost forever. Meg was saying something. She shook my shoulders. She put her face nose to nose with mine so my own derelict reflection stared back at me from the lenses of her cat-eye glasses. She slapped me. Hard. And I managed to decipher her words.
Get up!
Somehow I did. Then I doubled over and retched. I hadn't vomited in centuries. I'd forgotten how unpleasant it was. The next thing I knew, we were staggering along, Meg bearing most of my weight. The voices whispered and argued, tearing off little pieces of my mind and carrying them away into the forest. Soon I wouldn't have much left. There was no point. I might as well wander off into the forest and go insane. The idea struck me as funny. I began to giggle. Meg forced me to keep walking. I couldn't understand her words, but her tone was insistent and stubborn, with just enough anger to outweigh her own terror. In my fractured mental state, I thought the trees were parting for us, grudgingly opening a path straight out of the woods. I saw a bonfire in the distance, and the open meadows of Camp Half-Blood. It occurred to me that Meg was talking to the trees, telling them to get out of the way. The idea was ridiculous, and at the moment, it seemed hilarious. Judging from the steam billowing from my clothes, I guessed I was running a fever of about 106. I was laughing hysterically as we stumbled out of the forest, straight toward the campfire where a dozen teenagers sat making s'mores. When they saw us, they rose. In their jeans and winter coats, with assorted weapons at their sides, they were the dourest bunch of marshmallow roasters I had ever seen. I grinned.
Oh, hi. I'm Apollo.
My eyes rolled up in my head, and I passed out. Chapter 10. My bus is in flames. My son is older than me. Please, Zeus, make it stop. I dreamed I was driving the sun chariot across the sky. I had the top down in Maserati mode. I was cruising along, honking at jet planes to get out of my way, enjoying the smell of cold stratosphere, and bopping to my favorite jam, Alabama Shakes, Rise to the Sun. I was thinking about transforming the Spider into a Google self-driving car. I wanted to get out my lute and play a scorching solo that would make Brittany Howard proud. Then a woman appeared in my passenger seat.
You've got to hurry, man.
I almost jumped out of the sun. My guest was dressed like a Libyan queen of old. I should know. I dated a few of them. Her gown swirled with red, black, and gold floral designs. Her long, dark hair was crowned with a tiara that looked like a curved miniature ladder. Two gold rails lined with rungs of silver. Her face was mature but stately, the way a benevolent queen should look. So definitely not Hera, then. Besides, Hera would never smile at me so kindly. Also, this woman wore a large metal peace symbol around her neck, which did not seem like Hera's style. Still, I felt I should know her. Despite the elder hippie vibe, she was so attractive that I assumed we must be related. "Who are you?" I asked. Her eyes flashed a dangerous shade of gold, like a feline predator's. "Follow the voices." A lump swelled in my throat. I tried to think straight, but my brain felt like it had been recently run through a Vitamix. "I heard you in the woods. Were you speaking a prophecy?" "Find the gates." She grabbed my wrist. "You've got to find them first. You dig?" "But..." The woman burst into flames. I pulled back my singed wrist and grabbed the wheel as the sun chariot plunged into a nosedive. The Maserati morphed into a school bus, a mode I only used when I had to transport a large number of people. Smoke filled the cabin. Somewhere behind me, a nasal voice said, "By all means, find the gates." I glanced in the rearview mirror. Through the smoke, I saw a portly man in a mauve suit. He lounged across the back seat, where the troublemakers normally sat. Hermes was fond of that seat, but this man was not Hermes. He had a weak jawline, an overlarge nose, and a beard that wrapped around his double chin like a helmet strap. His hair was curly and dark like mine, except not as fashionably tousled or luxuriant. His lip curled as if he smelled something unpleasant. Perhaps it was the burning seats of the bus. "Who are you?" I yelled, desperately trying to pull the chariot out of its dive. "Why are you on my bus?" The man smiled, which made his face even uglier. "My own forefather does not recognize me. I'm hurt." I tried to place him. My cursed mortal brain was too small, too inflexible. It had jettisoned 4,000 years of memories like so much ballast. I don't, I said. "I'm sorry." The man laughed as flames licked at his purple sleeves. "You're not sorry yet, but you will be. Find me the gates. Lead me to the oracle. I'll enjoy burning it down." Fire consumed me as the sun chariot careened toward the earth. I gripped the wheel and stared in horror as a massive bronze face loomed outside the windshield. It was the face of the man in purple, fashioned from an expanse of metal larger than my bus. As we hurtled toward it, the features shifted and became my own. Then I woke, shivering and sweating. "Easy." Someone's hand rested on my shoulder. "Don't try to sit up." Naturally, I tried to sit up. My bedside attendant was a young man about my age, my mortal age, with shaggy blonde hair and blue eyes. He wore doctor's scrubs with an open ski jacket, the words Okemo Mountain stitched on the pocket. His face had a skier's tan. I felt I should know him. I'd been having that sensation a lot since my fall from Olympus. I was lying in a cot in the middle of a cabin. On either side, bunk beds lined the walls. Rough cedar beams ribbed the ceiling. The white plaster walls were bare except for a few hooks for coats and weapons. It could have been a modest abode in almost any age,
Ancient Athens, medieval France, the farmlands of Iowa. It smelled of clean linen and dried sage. The only decorations were some flower pots on the windowsill, where cheerful yellow blooms were thriving, despite the cold weather outside.
Those flowers.
My voice was hoarse, as if I'd inhaled the smoke from my dream.
Those are from Delos, my sacred island.
Yep, said the young man. They only grow in and around Cabin 7, your cabin. Do you know who I am? I studied his face, the calmness of his eyes, the smile resting easily on his lips, the way his hair curled around his ears. I had a vague memory of a woman, an alt-country singer named Naomi Solis, whom I'd met in Austin. I blushed thinking about her even now. To my teenaged self, a romance felt like something that I'd watched in a movie a long time ago. A movie my parents wouldn't have allowed me to see. But this boy was definitely Naomi's son, which meant he was my son, too. Which felt very, very strange.
You're Will Solis, I said.
Yeah, Will agreed. It's awkward. My frontal lobe did a 180 inside my skull. I listed sideways.
Whoa there, Will steadied me. I tried to heal you, but honestly, I don't understand what's wrong.
You've got blood, not ichor. You're recovering quickly from your injuries, but your vital signs are completely human.
Don't remind me.
Yeah, well... He put his hand on my forehead and frowned in concentration. His fingers trembled slightly. I didn't know any of that until I tried to give you nectar. Your lips started steaming. I almost killed you.
Ah.
I ran my tongue across my bottom lip, which felt heavy and numb. I wondered if that explained my dream about smoke and fire. I hoped so. I guess Meg forgot to tell you about my condition.
I guess she did.
Will took my wrist and checked my pulse.
You seem to be about my age, 15 or so.
Your heart rate is back to normal. Ribs are mending. Nose is swollen but not broken.
And I have acne, I lamented.
And flab. Will tilted his head. You're mortal, and that's what you're worried about?
You're right.
I'm powerless. Weaker even than you puny demigods.
Gee, thanks.
I got the feeling that he almost said dad, but managed to stop himself. It was difficult to think of this young man as my son. He was so poised, so unassuming, so free of acne. He also didn't appear to be awestruck in my presence. In fact, the corner of his mouth had started twitching.
Are you amused? I demanded.
Will shrugged.
Well, it's either find this funny or freak out. My dad, the god Apollo, is a 15-year-old...
16, I corrected. Let's go with 16. A 16-year-old mortal, lying in a cot in my cabin and with all my healing arts, which I got from you, I still can't figure out how to fix you.
There is no fixing this, I said miserably. I am cast out of Olympus.
My fate is tied to a girl named Meg.
It could not be worse.
Will laughed, which I thought took a great deal of gall.
Meg seems cool.
She's already poked Connor Stoll in the eyes and kicked Sherman Yang in the crotch.
She did what?
She'll get along just fine here. She's waiting for you outside, along with most of the campers.
Will's smile faded.
Just so you're prepared, they're asking a lot of questions. Everybody is wondering if your arrival, your mortal situation,
has anything to do with what's been going on at camp. I frowned. What has been going on at camp? The cabin door opened. Two more demigods stepped inside. One was a tall boy of about 13. His skin burnished bronze, and his cornrows woven like DNA helixes. In his black wool peacoat and black jeans, he looked as if he'd stepped from the deck of an 18th-century whaling vessel. The other newcomer was a younger girl in olive camouflage. She had a full quiver on her shoulder, and her short ginger hair was dyed with a shock of bright green, which seemed to defeat the point of wearing camouflage. I smiled, delighted that I actually remembered their names. "Austin," I said. "And Kayla, isn't it?" Rather than falling to their knees and blubbering gratefully, they gave each other a nervous glance. "So, it's really you," Kayla said. Austin frowned. "Meg told us you were beaten up by a couple of thugs. She said you had no powers and you went hysterical out in the woods." My mouth tasted like burnt school bus upholstery. "Meg talks too much." "But you're mortal?" Kayla asked. "As in completely mortal? Does that mean I'm going to lose my archery skills? I can't even qualify for the Olympics until I'm 16. "And if I lose my music?" Austin shook his head. "Oh man, that's wrong. My last video got like 500,000 views in a week. What am I supposed to do?" It warmed my heart that my children had the right priorities. Their skills, their images, their views on YouTube. Say what you will about gods being absentee parents, our children inherit many of our finest personality traits. "My problem should not affect you," I promised. "If Zeus went around retroactively yanking my divine power out of all my descendants, half the medical schools in the country would be empty. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame would disappear. The tarot card reading industry would collapse overnight." Austin's shoulders relaxed. "That's a relief." "So if you die while you're mortal," Kayla said, "we won't disappear?" "Guys," Will interrupted, "why don't you run to the big house and tell Chiron that our patient is conscious? I'll bring him along in a minute. And see if you can disperse the crowd outside, okay? I don't want everybody rushing Apollo at once." Kayla and Austin nodded sagely. As my children, they no doubt understood the importance of controlling the paparazzi. As soon as they were gone, Will gave me an apologetic smile. "They're in shock. We all are. It'll take some time to get used to whatever this is." "You do not seem shocked," I said. Will laughed under his breath. "I'm terrified. But one thing you learn as head counselor, you have to keep it together for everyone else. Let's get you on your feet." It was not easy. I fell twice. My head spun, and my eyes felt as if they were being microwaved in their sockets. Recent dreams continued to churn in my brain like river silt, muddying my thoughts. The woman with the crown and the peace symbol. The man in the purple suit. "Lead me to the oracle. I'll enjoy burning it down." The cabin began to feel stifling. I was anxious to get some fresh air. One thing my sister Artemis and I agree on. Every worthwhile pursuit is better outdoors than indoors. Music is best played under the dome of heaven. Poetry should be shared in the agora. Archery is definitely easier outside, as I can attest after that one time I tried target practice in my father's throne room. And driving the sun, well, that's not really an indoor sport either. Leaning on Will for support, I stepped outside. Kayla and Austin had succeeded in shooing the crowd away. The only one waiting for me, oh joy and happiness, was my young overlord Meg, who had apparently now gained fame at camp as Crutch Kicker McCaffrey. She still wore Sally Jackson's hand-me-down green dress, though it was a bit dirtier now. Her leggings were ripped and torn. On her bicep, a line of butterfly bandages closed a nasty cut she must have gotten in the woods. She took one look at me, scrunched up her face, and stuck out her tongue.
"You look yuck."
"And you, Meg," I said, "are as charming as ever." She adjusted her glasses until they were just crooked enough to be annoying.
"Thought you were going to die."
"Glad to disappoint you."
"Nah,"
she shrugged.
"You still owe me a year of service. We're bound, whether you like it or not."
I sighed. It was ever so wonderful to be back in Meg's company. "I suppose I should thank you." I had a hazy memory of my delirium in the forest, Meg carrying me along, the trees seeming to part before us. "How did you get us out of the woods?" Her expression turned guarded.
"Don't know. Luck."
She jabbed a thumb at Will Solace.
"From what he's been telling me, it's a good thing we got out before nightfall."
"Why?" Will started to answer, then apparently thought better of it. "I should let Chiron explain. Come on." I rarely visited Camp Half-Blood in winter. The last time had been 3 years ago, when a girl named Thalia Grace crash-landed my bus in the canoe lake. I expected the camp to be sparsely populated. I knew most demigods only came for the summer, leaving a small core of year-rounders during the school term. Those who, for various reasons, found camp the only safe place they could live. Still, I was struck by how few demigods I saw. If Cabin 7 was any indication, each god's cabin could hold beds for about 20 campers. That meant a maximum capacity of 400 demigods. Enough for several phalanxes, or one really amazing yacht party. Yet as we walked across camp, I saw no more than a dozen people. In the fading light of sunset, a lone girl was scaling the climbing wall, as lava flowed down either side. At the lake, a crew of three checked the rigging on the trireme. Some campers had found reasons to be outside just so they could gawk at me. Over by the hearth, one young man sat polishing his shield, watching me and its reflective surface. Another fellow glared at me as he spliced barbed wire outside the Ares cabin. From the awkward way he walked, I assumed he was Sherman Yang of the recently kicked crotch. In the doorway of the Hermes cabin, two girls giggled and whispered as I passed. Normally, this sort of attention wouldn't have fazed me. My magnetism was understandably irresistible. But now my face burned. Me, the manly paragon of romance, reduced to a gawky, inexperienced boy. I would have screamed at the heavens for this unfairness, but that would have been super embarrassing. We made our way through the fallow strawberry fields. Up on Half-Blood Hill, the golden fleece glinted in the lowest branch of a tall pine tree. Whiffs of steam rose from the head of Peleus, the guardian dragon coiled around the base of the trunk. Next to the tree, the Athena Parthenos looked angry red in the sunset. Or perhaps she just wasn't happy to see me. Athena had never gotten over our little tiff during the Trojan War. Halfway down the hillside, I spotted the Oracle's cave, its entrance shrouded by thick burgundy curtains. The torches on either side stood unlit, usually a sign that my prophetess, Rachel Dare, was not in residence. I wasn't sure whether to be disappointed or relieved. Even when she was not channeling prophecies, Rachel was a wise young lady. I had hoped to consult her about my problems. On the other hand, since her prophetic power had apparently stopped working, which I suppose in some small part was my fault, I wasn't sure Rachel would want to see me. She would expect explanations from her main man, and while I had invented mansplaining and was its foremost practitioner, I had no answers to give her. The dream of the flaming bus stayed with me. The groovy crowned woman urging me to find the gates. The ugly mauve-suited man threatening to burn the oracle.
Well, the cave was right there. I wasn't sure why the woman in the crown was having such trouble finding it, or why the ugly man would be so intent on burning its gates, which amounted to nothing more than purple curtains. Unless the dream was referring to something other than the Oracle of Delphi. I rubbed my throbbing temples. I kept reaching for memories that weren't there, trying to plunge into my vast lake of knowledge, only to find it had been reduced to a kiddie pool. You simply can't do much with a kiddie pool brain. On the porch of the big house, a dark-haired young man was waiting for us. He wore faded black trousers, a Ramones t-shirt, bonus points for musical taste, and a black leather bomber jacket. At his side hung a Stygian iron sword.
"I remember you," I said. "Is it Nicholas, son of Hades?"
"Nico D'Angelo." He studied me, his eyes sharp and colorless like broken glass. "So it's true. You're completely mortal. There's an aura of death around you, a thick possibility of death."
Meg snorted. "Sounds like a weather forecast."
I did not find this amusing. Being face to face with the son of Hades, I recalled the many mortals I had sent to the underworld with my plague arrows. It had always seemed like good, clean fun, meting out richly deserved punishments for wicked deeds. Now I began to understand the terror in my victim's eyes. I did not want an aura of death hanging over me. I definitely did not want to stand in judgment before Nico D'Angelo's father. Will put his hand on Nico's shoulder.
"Nico, we need to have another talk about your people skills."
"Hey, I'm just stating the obvious. If this is Apollo and he dies, we're all in trouble."
Will turned to me. "I apologize for my boyfriend."
Nico rolled his eyes.
"Could you not?
Would you prefer special guy?" Will asked.
"Or significant other?"
"Significant annoyance in your case," Nico grumbled.
"Oh, I'll get you for that."
Meg wiped her dripping nose. "You guys fight a lot. I thought we were going to see a centaur."
"And here I am."
The screen door opened. Chiron trotted out, ducking his head to avoid the doorframe. From the waist up, he looked every bit the professor he often pretended to be in the mortal world. His brown wool jacket had patches on the elbows. His plaid dress shirt did not quite match his green tie. His beard was neatly trimmed, but his hair would have failed the tidiness inspection required for a proper rat's nest. From the waist down, he was a white stallion. My old friend smiled, though his eyes were stormy and distracted.
"Apollo, it's good you are here. We need to talk about the disappearances."
Chapter 11. Check your spam folder. The prophecies might be there. No? Well, I'm stumped. Bye. Meg gawked.
He really is a centaur.
"Well spotted," I said. "I suppose the lower body of a horse is what gave him away?" She punched me in the arm. "Chiron," I said. "This is Meg McCaffrey, my new master and wellspring of aggravation. You were saying something about disappearances?"
Chiron's tail flicked. His hooves clopped on the planks of the porch. He was immortal, yet his visible age seemed to vary from century to century. I did not remember his whiskers ever being so gray, or the lines around his eyes so pronounced. Whatever was happening at camp must not have been helping his stress levels.
"Welcome, Meg."
Chiron tried for a friendly tone, which I thought quite heroic, seeing as, well, Meg.
"I understand you showed great bravery in the woods. You brought Apollo here despite many dangers. I'm glad to have you at Camp Half-Blood."
"Thanks," said Meg. "You're really tall.
Don't you hit your head on light fixtures?
Chiron chuckled.
Sometimes. If I want to be closer to human size, I have a magical wheelchair that allows me to compact my lower half into... Actually, that's not important now.
Disappearances, I prompted. What has disappeared?
Not what, but who, Chiron said. Let's talk inside. Will, Nico, could you please tell the other campers we'll gather for dinner in 1 hour? I'll give everyone an update then. In the meantime, no one should roam the camp alone. Use the buddy system.
Understood. Will looked at Nico. Will you be my buddy?
You are a dork, Nico announced.
The two of them strolled off bickering. At this point, you may be wondering how I felt seeing my son with Nico D'Angelo. I'll admit I did not understand Will's attraction to a child of Hades, but if the dark, foreboding type was what made Will happy... Oh, perhaps some of you were wondering how I felt seeing him with a boyfriend rather than a girlfriend. If that's the case, please, the gods are not hung up about such things. I myself have had, let's see, 33 mortal girlfriends and 11 mortal boyfriends? I've lost count. My two greatest loves were, of course, Daphne and Hyacinthus. But when you're a god as popular as I am... Hold on. Did I just tell you who I liked? I did, didn't I? Gods of Olympus, forget I mentioned their names. I am so embarrassed. Please don't say anything. In this mortal life, I've never been in love with anyone. I am so confused. Chiron led us into the living room, where comfy leather couches made a V facing the stone fireplace. Above the mantel, a stuffed leopard head was snoring contentedly.
Is it alive? Meg asked.
Quite.
Chiron trotted over to his wheelchair.
That's Seymour. If we speak quietly, we should be able to avoid waking him.
Meg immediately began exploring the living room. Knowing her, she was searching for small objects to throw at the leopard to wake him up. Chiron settled into his wheelchair. He placed his rear legs into the false compartment of the seat, then backed up, magically compacting his equine hindquarters until he looked like a man sitting down. To complete the illusion, hinged front panels swung closed, giving him fake human legs. Normally, those legs were fitted with slacks and loafers to augment his professor disguise. But today it seemed Chiron was going for a different look.
That's new, I said.
Chiron glanced down at his shapely female mannequin legs, dressed in fishnet stockings and red sequined high heels. He sighed heavily. I see the Hermes cabin have been watching Rocky Horror Picture Show again. I will have to have a chat with them. Rocky Horror Picture Show brought back fond memories. I used to cosplay as Rocky at the midnight showings because, naturally, the character's perfect physique was based on my own. Let me guess, I said. Connor and Travis Stoll are the pranksters. From a nearby basket, Chiron grabbed a flannel blanket and spread it over his fake legs, though the ruby shoes still peeked out at the bottom.
Actually, Travis went off to college last autumn, which has mellowed Connor quite a bit.
Meg looked over from the old Pac-Man arcade game.
I poked that guy Connor in the eyes.
Chiron winced.
That's a nice dare. At any rate, we have Julia Feingold and Alice Miyazawa now. They have taken up pranking duty. You'll meet them soon enough.
I recalled the girls who had been giggling at me from the Hermes cabin doorway. I felt myself blushing all over again. Chiron gestured toward the couches.
Please, sit.
Meg moved on from Pac-Man, having given the game 20 seconds of her time, and began literally climbing the wall. Dormant grapevines festooned the dining area, no doubt the work of my old friend Dionysus. Meg scaled one of the thicker trunks
trying to reach the Gorgon hair chandelier. Meg, I said, perhaps you should watch the orientation film while Chiron and I talk.
I know plenty, she said. I talked to the campers while you were passed out. Safe place for modern demigods, blah blah blah.
Oh, but the film is very good, I urged. I shot it on a tight budget in the 1950s. But some of the camera work was revolutionary. You should really... The grapevine peeled away from the wall. Meg crashed to the floor. She popped up, completely unscathed, then spotted a platter of cookies on the sideboard.
Are those free?
Yes, child, Chiron said. Bring the tea as well, would you? So we were stuck with Meg, who draped her legs over the couch's armrest, chomped on cookies, and threw crumbs at Seymour's snoring head whenever Chiron wasn't looking. Chiron poured me a cup of Darjeeling.
I'm sorry Mr. D is not here to welcome you.
Mr. D? Meg asked.
Dionysus, I explained, the god of wine, also the director of this camp. Chiron handed me my tea.
After the battle with Gia, I thought Mr. D might return to camp, but he never did. I hope he's all right.
The old centaur looked at me expectantly, but I had nothing to share. The last 6 months were a complete void. I had no idea what the other Olympians might be up to.
I don't know anything, I admitted.
I hadn't said those words very often in the last 4 millennia. They tasted bad. I sipped my tea, but that was no less bitter. I'm a bit behind on the news. I was hoping you could fill me in. Chiron did a poor job hiding his disappointment.
I see.
I realized he had been hoping for help and guidance, the exact same things I needed from him. As a god, I was used to lesser beings relying on me, praying for this and pleading for that. But now that I was mortal, being relied upon was a little terrifying.
So what is your crisis? I asked.
You have the same look Cassandra had in Troy, or Jim Bowie at the Alamo, as if you're under siege.
Chiron did not dispute the comparison. He cupped his hands around his tea.
You know that during the war with Gia, the Oracle of Delphi stopped receiving prophecies. In fact, all known methods of divining the future suddenly failed.
Because the original cave of Delphi was retaken, I said with a sigh, trying not to feel picked on.
Meg bounced a chocolate chip off Seymour the leopard's nose.
Oracle of Delphi. Percy mentioned that.
Percy Jackson?
Chiron sat up.
Percy was with you.
For a time.
I recounted our battle in the peach orchard and Percy's return to New York. He said he would drive out this weekend if he could.
Chiron looked disheartened, as if my company alone wasn't good enough. Can you imagine?
At any rate, he continued. We hoped that once the war was over, the Oracle might start working again. When it did not, Rachel became concerned.
Who's Rachel? Meg asked.
Rachel Dare, I said. The Oracle.
Thought the Oracle was a place.
It is.
Then Rachel is a place and she stopped working?
Had I still been a god, I would have turned her into a blue-belly lizard and released her into the wilderness, never to be seen again.
The thought soothed me.
The original Delphi was a place in Greece, I told her. A cavern filled with volcanic fumes, where people would come to receive guidance from my priestess, the Pythia.
Pythia?
Meg giggled.
That's a funny word.
Yes, ha-ha. So the Oracle is both a place and a person. When the Greek gods relocated to America back in... What was it, Chiron? 1860?
Chiron seesawed his hand.
More or less.
I brought the Oracle here to continue speaking prophecies on my behalf. The power has passed down from priestess to priestess over the years, Rachel Dare is the present Oracle. From the cookie platter, Meg plucked the only Oreo, which I had been hoping to have myself.
"'Mm-kay. Is it too late to watch that movie?"
"Yes," I snapped. Now, the way I gained possession of the Oracle of Delphi in the first place was by killing this monster called Python, who lived in the depths of the cavern.
"A python like the snake," Meg said.
"Yes and no. The snake species is named after Python the monster, who is also rather snaky, but who is much bigger and scarier and devours small girls who talk too much. At any rate, last August, while I was indisposed, my ancient foe Python was released from Tartarus. He reclaimed the Cave of Delphi. That's why the Oracle stopped working."
"But if the Oracle is in America now, why does it matter if some snake monster takes over its old cave?"
That was about the longest sentence I had yet heard her speak. She'd probably done it just to spite me. "It's too much to explain," I said. "You'll just have to..." "Meg." Chiron gave her one of his heroically tolerant smiles. "The original site of the Oracle is like the deepest taproot of a tree. The branches and leaves of prophecy may extend across the world, and Rachel Dare may be our loftiest branch. But if the taproot is strangled, the whole tree is endangered. With Python back in residence at his old lair, the spirit of the Oracle has been completely blocked."
"Oh," Meg made a face at me. "Why didn't you just say so?"
Before I could strangle her like the annoying taproot she was, Chiron refilled my teacup.
"The larger problem," he said, "is that we have no other source of prophecies."
"Who cares?" Meg asked. "So you don't know the future. Nobody knows the future."
"Who cares?" I shouted. "Meg McCaffrey, prophecies are the catalysts for every important event. Every quest or battle, disaster or miracle, birth or death. Prophecies don't simply foretell the future. They shape it. They allow the future to happen."
"I don't get it."
Chiron cleared his throat.
"Imagine prophecies are flower seeds. With the right seeds, you can grow any garden you desire. Without seeds, no growth is possible."
"Oh," Meg nodded. "That would suck."
I found it strange that Meg, a street urchin and dumpster warrior, would relate so well to garden metaphors. But Chiron was an excellent teacher. He had picked up on something about the girl. An impression that had been lurking in the back of my mind as well. I hoped I was wrong about what it meant, but with my luck, I would be right. I usually was. "So, where is Rachel Dare?" I asked. "Perhaps if I spoke with her." Chiron set down his tea.
"Rachel planned to visit us during her winter vacation, but she never did. It might not mean anything."
I leaned forward. It was not unheard of for Rachel Dare to be late. She was artistic, unpredictable, impulsive, and rule-averse, all qualities I dearly admired. But it wasn't like her not to show up at all.
"Or?" I asked. "Or it might be part of the larger problem," Chiron said. "Prophecies are not the only things that have failed. Travel and communication have become difficult in the last few months. We haven't heard from our friends at Camp Jupiter in weeks. No new demigods have arrived. Satyrs aren't reporting from the field. Iris messages no longer work."
"Iris what?" Meg asked.
"Two-way visions," I said. "A form of communication overseen by the Rainbow Goddess. Iris has always been flighty.
Except that normal human communications are also on the fritz," Chiron said. "Of course, phones have always been dangerous for demigods."
"Yeah, they attract monsters,"
Meg agreed.
I haven't used a phone in forever.
A wise move, Karen said. But recently our phones have stopped working altogether. Mobile, landline, internet. It doesn't seem to matter. Even the archaic form of communication known as email is strangely unreliable. The messages simply don't arrive.
Did you look in the junk folder? I offered.
I fear the problem is more complicated, Kyron said. We have no communication with the outside world. We are alone and understaffed. You are the first newcomers in almost 2 months.
I frowned. Percy Jackson mentioned nothing of this.
I doubt Percy is even aware, Kyron said. He's been busy with school. Winter is normally our quietest time. For a while, I was able to convince myself that the communication failures were nothing but an inconvenient happenstance. Then the disappearances started.
In the fireplace, a log slipped from the andiron. I may or may not have jumped in my seat. The disappearances, yes. I wiped drops of tea from my pants and tried to ignore Meg's snickering. Tell me about those.
3 in the last month, Kyron said. First it was Cecil Markowitz from the Hermes cabin. One morning his bunk was simply empty. He didn't say anything about wanting to leave. No one saw him go. And in the past few weeks, no one has seen or heard from him.
Children of Hermes do tend to sneak around, I offered.
At first, that's what we thought, said Kyron. But a week later, Ellis Wakefield disappeared from the Ares cabin. Same story. Empty bunk. No signs that he had either left on his own or was, taken.
Ellis was an impetuous young man. It was conceivable he might have charged off on some ill-advised adventure, but it made me uneasy.
Then, this morning, we realized a third camper had vanished. Miranda Gardiner, head of the Demeter cabin. That was the worst news of all.
Meg swung her feet off the armrest.
Why is that the worst?
Miranda is one of our senior counselors, Karen said. She would never leave on her own without notice. She is too smart to be tricked away from camp and too powerful to be forced. Yet something happened to her. Something I can't explain.
The old centaur faced me.
Something is very wrong, Apollo.
These problems may not be as alarming as the rise of Kronos or the awakening of Gia, but in a way I find them even more unsettling, because I have never seen anything like this before.
I recalled my dream of the burning sunbus. I thought of the voices I'd heard in the woods, urging me to wander off and find their source.
These demigods, I said. Before they disappeared, did they act unusual in any way? Did they report hearing things?
Kyron raised an eyebrow.
Not that I am aware of. Why?
I was reluctant to say more. I didn't want to cause a panic without knowing what we were facing. When mortals panic, it can be an ugly scene, especially if they expect me to fix the problem. Also, I will admit, I felt a bit impatient. We had not yet addressed the most important issues. Mine.
It seems to me, I said, that our first priority is to bend all the camp's resources to helping me regain my divine state. Then I can assist you with these other problems.
Kyron stroked his beard.
But what if the problems are connected, my friend? What if the only way to restore you to Olympus is by reclaiming the Oracle of Delphi, thus freeing the power of prophecy? What if Delphi is the key to it all?
I had forgotten about Chiron's tendency to lay out obvious and logical conclusions that I tried to avoid thinking about. It was an infuriating habit. In my present state, that's impossible. I pointed at Meg. Right now, my job is to serve this demigod, probably for a year. After I've done whatever tasks she assigns me, Zeus will judge that my sentence has been served, and I can once again become a god. Meg pulled apart a Fig Newton. I could order you to go to this Delphi place.
No!
My voice cracked in mid-shriek.
You should assign me easy tasks, like starting a rock band or just hanging out.
Yes, hanging out is good. Meg looked unconvinced.
Hanging out isn't a task.
It is if you do it right.
Camp Half-Blood can protect me while I hang out. After my year of servitude is up, I'll become a god. Then we can talk about how to restore Delphi.
Preferably, I thought, by ordering some demigods to undertake the quest for me.
Apollo, Chiron said, if demigods keep disappearing, we may not have a year. We may not have the strength to protect you, and forgive me, but Delphi is your responsibility.
I tossed up my hands. I wasn't the one who opened the doors of death and let Python out. Blame Gia. Blame Zeus for his bad judgment. When the giants started to wake, I drew up a very clear 20-point plan of action to protect Apollo and also you other gods. But he didn't even read it.
Meg tossed half of her cookie at Seymour's head.
I still think it's your fault.
Hey, look, he's awake.
She said this as if the leopard had decided to wake up on his own, rather than being beamed in the eye with a Fig Newton. Seymour complained. Chiron wheeled his chair back from the table.
My dear, in that jar on the mantel you'll find some snossages. Why don't you feed him dinner? Apollo and I will wait on the porch.
We left Meg happily making 3-point shots into Seymour's mouth with the treats. Once Chiron and I reached the porch, he turned his wheelchair to face me.
She's an interesting demigod.
Interesting is such a non-judgmental term.
She really summoned a Karpos?
Well, the spirit appeared when she was in trouble. Whether she consciously summoned it, I don't know. She named him Peaches.
Chiron scratched his beard.
I have not seen a demigod with the power to summon grain spirits in a very long time. You know what it means?
My feet began to quake.
I have my suspicions. I'm trying to stay positive.
She guided you out of the woods, Chiron noted. Without her?
Yes, I said. Don't remind me.
It occurred to me that I'd seen that keen look in Chiron's eyes before. When he'd assessed Achilles' sword technique and Ajax's skill with a spear, it was the look of a seasoned coach scouting new talent. I'd never dreamed the centaur would look at me that way, as if I had something to prove to him, as if my mettle were untested. I felt so objectified.
Tell me, Chiron said, what did you hear in the woods?
I silently cursed my big mouth. I should not have asked whether the missing demigods had heard anything strange. I decided it was fruitless to hold back now. Chiron was more perceptive than your average horseman. I told him what I'd experienced in the forest, and afterward in my dream. His hands curled into his lap blanket. The bottom of it rose higher above his red sequined pumps. He looked about as worried as it is possible for a man to look while wearing fishnet stockings.
We will have to warn the campers to stay away from the forest, he decided. I do not understand what is happening. But I still maintain it must be connected to Delphi, and your present, situation. The Oracle must be liberated from the monster Python. We must find a way.
I translated that easily enough. I must find a way. Chiron must have read my desolate expression.
Come, come, old friend, he said. You have done it before. Perhaps you are not a god now,
But the first time you killed Python, it was no challenge at all. Hundreds of storybooks have praised the way you easily slew your enemy.
Yes, I muttered. Hundreds of storybooks. I recalled some of those stories. I had killed Python without breaking a sweat. I flew to the mouth of the cave, called him out, unleashed an arrow, and boom! One dead giant snake monster. I became Lord of Delphi, and we all lived happily ever after. How do storytellers get the idea that I vanquished Python so quickly? All right. Possibly it's because I told them so. Still, the truth was rather different. For centuries after our battle, I had bad dreams about my old foe. Now I was almost grateful for my imperfect memory. I could not recollect all of the nightmarish details of my fight with Python, but I did know he had been no pushover. I had needed all my godly strength, my divine powers, and the world's most deadly bow. What chance would I have as a 16-year-old mortal with acne, hand-me-down clothes, and the nom de guerre Lester Papadopoulos? I was not going to charge off to Greece and get myself killed, thank you very much. Especially not without my sun chariot or the ability to teleport. I'm sorry. Gods do not fly commercial. I tried to figure out how to explain this to Chiron in a calm, diplomatic way that did not involve stomping my feet or screaming. I was saved from the effort by the sound of a conch horn in the distance.
That means dinner. The centaur forced a smile. We will talk more later, eh? For now, let's celebrate your arrival.
Chapter 12. Ode to a hot dog, with bug juice and tater chips. I got nothing, man. I was not in the mood to celebrate, especially sitting at a picnic table eating mortal food with mortals. The dining pavilion was pleasant enough. Even in winter, the camp's magical borders shielded us from the worst of the elements. Sitting outdoors in the warmth of the torches and braziers, I felt only slightly chilly. Long Island Sound glittered in the light of the moon. Hello, Artemis. Don't bother to say hi. On Half-Blood Hill, the Athena Parthenos glowed like the world's largest nightlight. Even the woods did not seem so creepy, with the pine trees blanketed in soft silvery fog. My dinner, however, was less than poetic. It consisted of hot dogs, potato chips, and a red liquid I was told was bug juice. I did not know why humans consumed bug juice, or from which type of bug it had been extracted, but it was the tastiest part of the meal, which was disconcerting. I sat at the Apollo table with my children, Austin, Kayla, and Will, plus Nico D'Angelo. I could see no difference between my table and any of the other gods' tables. Mine should have been shinier and more elegant. It should have played music or recited poetry upon command. Instead, it was just a slab of stone with benches on either side. I found the seating uncomfortable, though my offspring didn't seem to mind. Austin and Kayla peppered me with questions about Olympus, the war with Gia, and what it felt like to be a god and then a human. I knew they did not mean to be rude. As my children, they were inherently inclined to the utmost grace. However, their questions were painful reminders of my fallen status. Besides, as the hours passed, I remembered less and less about my divine life. It was alarming how fast my cosmically perfect neurons had deteriorated. Once, each memory had been like a high-definition audio file. Now those recordings were on wax cylinders. And believe me, I remember wax cylinders. They did not last long in the sun chariot. Will and Nico sat shoulder to shoulder, bantering good-naturedly. They were so cute together it made me feel desolate. It jogged my memories of those few short golden months I'd shared with Hyacinthus before the jealousy, before the horrible accident. Nico, I said at last, shouldn't you be sitting at the Hades table? He shrugged. Technically, yes,
but if I sit alone at my table, strange things happen. Cracks open in the floor, zombies crawl out and start roaming around. It's a mood disorder. I can't control it. That's what I told Chiron.
And is it true? I asked.
Nico smiled thinly. I have a note from my doctor.
Will raised his hand.
I'm his doctor.
Chiron decided it wasn't worth arguing about, Nico said. As long as I sit at a table with other people like, oh, these guys, for instance, the zombies stay away. Everybody's happier.
Will nodded serenely. It's the strangest thing. Not that Nico would ever misuse his powers to get what he wants.
Of course not, Nico agreed.
I glanced across the dining pavilion. As per camp tradition, Meg had been placed with the children of Hermes, since her godly parentage had not yet been determined. Meg didn't seem to mind. She was busy recreating the Coney Island hot dog eating contest all by herself. The other two girls, Julia and Alice, watched her with a mixture of fascination and horror. Across the table from her sat an older, skinny boy with curly brown hair. Connor Stoll, I deduced, though I'd never been able to tell him apart from his older brother, Travis. Despite the darkness, Connor wore sunglasses, no doubt to protect his eyes from a repeat poking. I also noted that he wisely kept his hands away from Meg's mouth. In the entire pavilion, I counted 19 campers. Most sat alone at their respective tables. Sherman Yang for Ares, a girl I did not know for Aphrodite, another girl for Demeter. At the Nike table, two dark-haired young ladies, who were obviously twins, conversed over a war map. Chiron himself, again in full centaur form, stood at the head table, sipping his bug juice as he chatted with two satyrs, but their mood was subdued. The goatmen kept glancing at me, then eating their silverware as satyrs tend to do when nervous. Half a dozen gorgeous dryads moved between the tables, offering food and drink, but I was so preoccupied I couldn't fully appreciate their beauty. Even more tragic, I felt too embarrassed to flirt with them. What was wrong with me? I studied the campers, hoping to spot some potential servants. I mean, new friends. Gods always like to keep a few strong veteran demigods handy to throw into battle, send on dangerous quests, or pick the lint off our togas. Unfortunately, no one at dinner jumped out at me as a likely minion. I longed for a bigger pool of talent.
Where are the others? I asked Will.
I wanted to say the A-list, but I thought that might be taken the wrong way. Will took a bite of his pizza.
Were you looking for somebody in particular?
What about the ones who went on that quest with the boat? Will and Nico exchanged a look that might have meant, here we go. I suppose they got asked a lot about the seven legendary demigods who had fought side by side with the gods against Gia's giants. It pained me that I had not gotten to see those heroes again. After any major battle, I liked to get a group photo, along with exclusive rights to compose epic ballads about their exploits.
Well, Nico started, you saw Percy. He and Annabeth are spending their senior year in New York. Hazel and Frank are at Camp Jupiter doing the 12th Legion thing.
Ah, yes. I tried to bring up a clear mental picture of Camp Jupiter, the Roman enclave near Berkeley, California, but the details were hazy. I could only remember my conversations with Octavian, the way he'd turned my head with his flattery and promises. That stupid boy. It was his fault I was here. A voice whispered in the back of my mind. This time I thought it might be my conscience. Who was the stupid boy? It wasn't Octavian.
Shut up, I murmured.
What? Nico asked.
Nothing. Continue.
Jason and Piper are spending the school year in Los Angeles with Piper's dad. They took Coach Hedge, Melly, and Little Chuck with them.
Uh-huh. I did not know those last three names, so I decided they probably weren't important. And the seventh hero, Leo Valdez.
Nico raised his eyebrows.
You remember his name?
Of course! He invented the Valdezinator. Ah, what a musical instrument! I barely had time to master its major scales before Zeus zapped me at the Parthenon. If anyone could help me, it would be Leo Valdez.
Nico's expression tightened with annoyance.
Well, Leo isn't here. He died.
Then he came back to life.
And if I see him again, I'll kill him.
Will elbowed him.
No, you won't.
He turned to me. During the fight with Gia, Leo and his bronze dragon, Festus, disappeared in a mid-air fiery explosion. I shivered. After so many centuries driving the Sun Chariot, the term mid-air fiery explosion did not sit well with me. I tried to remember the last time I'd seen Leo Valdez on Delos, when he'd traded the Valdezinator for information. He was looking for the physician's cure, I recalled. The way to bring someone back from the dead. I suppose he planned all along to sacrifice himself?
Yep, Will said.
He got rid of Gia in the explosion, but we all assumed he died too.
Because he did, Nico said.
Then a few days later, Will continued, this scroll came fluttering into camp on the wind.
I still have it.
Nico rummaged through the pockets of his bomber jacket. I look at it whenever I want to get angry. He produced a thick parchment scroll. As soon as he spread it on the table, a flickering hologram appeared above the surface. Leo Valdez, looking impish as usual with his dark wispy hair, his mischievous grin, and his diminutive stature. Of course, the hologram was only 3 inches tall, but even in real life, Leo was not much more imposing. His jeans, blue work shirt, and tool belt were speckled with machine oil.
Hey, guys!
Leo spread his arms for a hug.
Sorry to leave you like that. Bad news? I died. Good news? I got better. I had to go rescue Calypso. We're both fine now. We're taking Festus to...
The image guttered like a flame in a strong breeze, disrupting Leo's voice.
Back as soon as...
Static.
Cook tacos when...
More static.
Vaya con queso! Love ya.
The image winked out.
That's all we got,
Nico complained.
And that was in August. We have no idea what he was planning, where he is now, or whether he's still safe.
Jason and Piper spent most of September looking for him, until Chiron finally insisted they go start their school year. Well, I said, it sounds like Leo was planning to cook tacos. Perhaps that took longer than he anticipated. And via con queso. I believe he is admonishing us to go with cheese, which is always sound advice. This did not seem to reassure Nico.
I don't like being in the dark, he muttered.
An odd complaint for a child of Hades, but I understood what he meant. I too was curious to know the fate of Leo Valdez. Once upon a time, I could have divined his whereabouts as easily as you might check a Facebook timeline, but now I could only stare at the sky and wonder when a small, impish demigod might appear with a bronze dragon and a plate of tacos. And if Calypso was involved, that complicated things. The sorceress and I had a rocky history, but even I had to admit she was beguiling. If she'd captured Leo's heart, it was entirely possible he had gotten sidetracked. Odysseus spent 7 years with her before returning home. Whatever the case, it seemed unlikely that Valdez would be back in time to help me. My quest to master the Valdezinator's arpeggios would have to wait. Kayla and Austin had been very quiet, following our conversation with wonder and amazement. My words have that effect on people. Now Kayla scooted toward me.
What did you guys talk about in the big house?
Chiron told you about the disappearances? Yes. I tried to avoid looking in the direction of the woods. We discussed the situation.
And?
Austin spread his fingers on the table. What's going on? I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't want them to see my fear. I wished my head would stop pounding. On Olympus, headaches were so much easier to cure. Hephaestus simply split one skull open and extracted whatever newborn god or goddess happened to be banging around in there. In the mortal world, my options were more limited. I need time to think about it, I said. Perhaps in the morning I'll have some of my godly powers back. Austin leaned forward. In the torchlight, his cornrows seemed to twist into new DNA patterns.
Is that how it works? Your strength comes back over time?
I think so. I tried to remember my years of servitude with Admetus and Laomedon, but I could barely conjure their names and faces. My contracting memory terrified me. It made each moment of the present balloon in size and importance, reminding me that time for mortals was limited. I have to get stronger, I decided. I must. Kayla squeezed my hand. Her archer's fingers were rough and calloused.
It's okay, Apollo. Dad? We'll help you.
Austin nodded.
Kayla's right. We're in this together. If anybody gives you trouble, Kayla will shoot them. Then I'll curse them so bad they'll be speaking in rhyming couplets for weeks.
My eyes watered. Not so long ago, like this morning, for instance, the idea of these young demigods being able to help me would have struck me as ridiculous. Now their kindness moved me more than 100 sacrificial bulls. I couldn't recall the last time someone had cared about me enough to curse my enemies with rhyming couplets.
Thank you, I managed.
I could not add my children. It didn't seem right. These demigods were my protectors and my family. But for the present, I could not think of myself as their father. A father should do more. A father should give more to his children than he takes. I have to admit that this was a novel idea for me. It made me feel even worse than before.
Hey, Will patted my shoulder. It's not so bad. At least with everybody being on high alert, we might not have to do Harley's obstacle course tomorrow.
Kayla muttered an ancient Greek curse. If I had been a proper godly father, I would have washed her mouth out with olive oil.
I forgot all about that, she said. They'll have to cancel it, won't they?
I frowned. What obstacle course? Chiron mentioned nothing about this. I wanted to object that my entire day had been an obstacle course. Surely they couldn't expect me to do their camp activities as well. Before I could say as much, one of the satyrs blew a conch horn at the head table. Chiron raised his arms for attention.
Campers!
His voice filled the pavilion. He could be quite impressive when he wanted to be.
I have a few announcements, including news about tomorrow's three-legged death race.
Chapter 13. Three-legged death race. Five terrible syllables. Oh, gods, please not Meg. It was all Harley's fault. After addressing the disappearance of Miranda Gardner, as a precautionary measure, please stay away from the woods until we know more. Chiron called forward the young son of Hephaestus to explain how the three-legged death race would work. It quickly became apparent that Harley had masterminded the whole project. And really, the idea was so horrifying, it could only have sprung from the mind of an 8-year-old boy. I confess I lost track of the specifics after he explained the exploding chainsaw frisbees.
And they'll be like, zoom!
He bounced up and down with excitement.
And then buzz! And pow!
He pantomimed all sorts of chaos with his hands.
You have to be really quick, or you'll die. And it's awesome.
The other campers grumbled and shifted on their benches. Chiron raised his hand for silence.
Now I know there were problems last time, he said. But fortunately our healers in the Apollo cabin were able to reattach Paolo's arms.
At a table in the back, a muscular teen boy rose and began ranting in what I thought was Portuguese. He wore a white tank top over his dark chest, and I could see faint white scars around the tops of his biceps. Cursing rapidly, he pointed at Harley, the Apollo cabin, and pretty much everyone else.
Ah, thank you, Paolo, Chiron said, clearly baffled. I'm glad you are feeling better.
Austin leaned toward me and whispered.
Paolo understands English okay, but he only speaks Portuguese. At least, that's what he claims. None of us can understand a word he says.
I didn't understand Portuguese either. Athena had been lecturing us for years about how Mount Olympus might migrate to Brazil someday, and we should all be prepared for the possibility. She'd even bought the gods Berlitz Portuguese DVDs for Saturnalia presents. But what does Athena know?
Paolo seems agitated, I noted.
Will shrugged.
He's lucky he's a fast healer. Son of Hebe, goddess of youth and all that.
You're staring, Nico noted.
I am not, Will said. I am merely assessing how well Paolo's arms are functioning after surgery.
Huh. Paolo finally sat down. Chiron went through a long list of other injuries they had experienced during the first three-legged death race, all of which he hoped to avoid this time. Second-degree burns, burst eardrums, a pulled groin, and two cases of chronic Irish step dancing.
The lone demigod at the Athena table raised his hand.
Chiron, just going to throw this out there. We've had three campers disappear. Is it really wise to be running a dangerous obstacle course?
Chiron gave him a pained smile.
An excellent question, Malcolm. But this course will not take you into the woods, which we believe is the most hazardous area. The satyrs, dryads, and I will continue to investigate the disappearances. We will not rest until our missing campers are found. In the meantime, however, this three-legged race can foster important team-building skills. It also expands our understanding of the labyrinth.
The words smacked me in the face like Ares's body odor. I turned to Austin.
The labyrinth? As in Daedalus's labyrinth?
Austin nodded, his fingers worrying the ceramic camp beads around his neck. I had a sudden memory of his mother, Latricia. The way she used to fiddle with her cowrie necklace when she lectured at Oberlin. Even I learned things from Latricia Lake's music theory class, though I had found her distractingly beautiful.
During the war with Gia, Austin said, the maze reopened. We've been trying to map it ever since.
That's impossible, I said.
Also insane. The labyrinth is a malevolent sentient creation. It can't be mapped or trusted.
As usual, I could only draw on random bits and pieces of my memories, but I was fairly certain I spoke the truth. I remembered Daedalus. Back in the old days, the king of Crete had ordered him to build a maze to contain the monstrous Minotaur. But oh no, a simple maze wasn't good enough for a brilliant inventor like Daedalus. He had to make his labyrinth self-aware and self-expanding. Over the centuries, it had honeycombed under the planet's surface, like an invasive root system. Stupid, brilliant inventors.
It's different now, Austin told me. Since Daedalus died, I don't know. It's hard to describe. Doesn't feel so evil. Not quite as deadly.
Oh, that's hugely reassuring. So of course you decided to do three-legged races through it.
Will coughed.
The other thing, Dad, nobody wants to disappoint Harley. I glanced at the head table. Chiron was still holding forth about the virtues of team building, while Harley bounced up and down. I could see why the other campers might adopt the boy as their unofficial mascot.
He was a cute little pipsqueak, even if he was scarily buff for an 8-year-old. His grin was infectious. His enthusiasm seemed to lift the mood of the entire group. Still, I recognized the mad gleam in his eyes. It was the same look his father Hephaestus got whenever he invented some automaton that would later go berserk and start destroying cities.
"Also keep in mind," Chiron was saying, "that none of the unfortunate disappearances has been linked to the labyrinth. Remain with your partner and you should be safe. At least, as safe as one can be in a 3-legged death race."
"Yeah," Harley said. "Nobody has even died yet."
He sounded disappointed, as if he wanted us to try harder.
"In the face of a crisis," Chiron said.